Chapter 2. Governor Rudy Perpich and the Brain Power State. A true visionary, Governor Perpich acted on his beliefs. 1985 to 1988. According to the history books, Minnesota DFL Governor Rudy Perpich had nothing to do with passage of chartering legislation in Minnesota. In reality, he had everything to do with it. Perpich's vision allowed more public school choice. Without the mandate for more choice, chartered schools would likely never have been created. I admired Perpich. A true visionary, he acted on his beliefs. He saw Minnesota as the brain power state and was committed to making it so. Minnesota voters elected Perpich to his second non-consecutive term as governor in 1982, the same year I was first elected to the Minnesota Senate. As an Iron Ranger from northern Minnesota, Perpich enjoyed strong labor support. Between his two terms as governor, he worked in the global business community for 4 years for Control Data Corporation in Vienna. This work greatly influenced him. Besides admiring Perpich, I also enjoyed a satisfying personal relationship with him, as I was one of few Croatians in the legislature, a heritage we shared. He was always respectful and kind to me, even though I was only 29 when I started my Senate service. I'm not sure if Perpich was a direct influence, but in 1984 I left my law firm and began a stint as in-house corporate counsel at Control Data Corporation. I really liked Perpich's ability to partner with business, and this became even more important when the Minnesota House of Representatives switched from DFL to Republican control in the 1984 election. After President Ronald Reagan's National Commission on Excellence in Education published A Nation at Risk in 1983, policymakers were put on notice that the nation's educational system was failing to meet the national need for a competitive workforce. Examples of academic underachievement noted in the now landmark report were sobering. Average scholastic aptitude test, SAT scores, fell over 50 points in the verbal section and over 40 points in the mathematics section during 1963 to 1980. Studies of student achievement in the 1970s revealed that in comparison with other industrialized nations, American students never ranked first or second on 19 academic tests, but ranked last 7 times. About 13% of all 17-year-olds in the U.S. were considered functionally illiterate, with that percentage running as high as 40% for minority youth. Nearly 40% of 17-year-olds tested could not draw inferences from written material. Only 1/5 could write a persuasive essay, and only 1/3 could solve a math problem requiring several steps. These statistics greatly troubled Perpich. While many governors looked to the commission's recommendations regarding increased course and graduation requirements, he didn't. "He wasn't so big on standards," recalled Dan Loritz, then Assistant Commissioner and Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. Rudy said that he'd seen too many people who failed tests and passed life, and too many people who passed tests and failed life. The governor was interested in creating more competition in education, which would be the access to excellence. His own personal experiences and those of his family moved the governor to action. When he was chair of the National Governors Association in 1989, he wrote the following in the foreword of the book Public Schools by Choice, edited by Joe Nathan. "Education was my passport out of poverty. I am a first-generation American. On entering the Hibbing, Minnesota public schools, I did not speak English. My teachers taught me English and many other things. They helped me develop the confidence which led to my running for local school board, the state legislature, and finally, governor. Education reform has been a special passion for me. It was an experience with my son and daughter many years ago that sparked my interest in choice. In the 1960s, our children attended the excellent public schools in Hibbing. After my election to the state legislature, we moved to the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. During that first legislative session, we rented a house without considering the schools our children would attend. Our children found that their classes were mostly a review of what they already had learned in Hibbing. But when my wife and I talked with teachers and school administrators, we learned that we had no options for more challenging assignments or moving our children to another classroom or school. During the next legislative session, our family looked first at schools before deciding where to rent a house. Unfortunately, few families can move from district to district until they are satisfied with the school. That is why I recommended in 1985 that we allow Minnesota families to select among various public schools as long as their movement did not harm desegregation efforts and the receiving district had room. The plan was not received warmly at first. In fact, one legislator who sponsored the bill said it was a little like trying to rearrange a cemetery. In 1985, with the Minnesota House of Representatives in Republican control, Perpich launched Access to Excellence, a comprehensive education reform agenda that seemed downright radical at the time. One initiative was Post-Secondary Enrollment Options, PSEO, legislation that would allow 11th and 12th grade public school students to enroll part-time or full-time in non-sectarian courses at Minnesota public and private colleges and universities and at public vocational technical schools at no cost to the student. Public funds would follow the students who would earn both high school and college credits. The purpose of the program was to promote rigorous educational pursuits and provide a wider range of choices for students. Another initiative within Access to Excellence was open enrollment, legislation that would allow public school students ages 5 to 18 to attend any public school of their choice in the state of Minnesota as long as their movement did not harm desegregation efforts and the receiving district had room. Again, the purpose was to provide greater access to choices for public school students. It was important that neither initiative required new spending during tight budget times. Both proposals were based, in part, on recommendations from a study commissioned by the Minnesota Business Partnership. They were also based, in part, on recommendations made by a small group of reformers who engaged in discussions with the governor before the new year and beyond. This group consisted of Ted Coldery, Joe Nathan, Kurt Johnson, and Vern Johnson, among others. Former Governor Al Quie was also involved as a longtime proponent of school choice. In 1983, as a member of Reagan's National Commission on Excellence in Education, Quie had tried unsuccessfully to get choice recommendations into the A Nation at Risk report. Both of Perpich's proposals, post-secondary enrollment options and open enrollment, created an immediate firestorm of protest from nearly all education groups. Most of the firestorm focused on open enrollment. A St. Paul Pioneer Press newspaper poll in 1985 indicated that opposition wasn't limited to educators. Minnesotans opposed the governor's open enrollment plan by nearly 2-1. Why? Senator Tom Nelson, then chair of the Senate Education Aid Subcommittee, addressed the issue more than 25 years later in an August 21, 2011 Pioneer Press article by Megan Bolt. It was a new paradigm. People didn't like it for two reasons. One was because funding was based on enrollment. You'd lose money. But two, if you lost too many students, you'd lose face. I did not become part of the story until 1988. In 1985, still a first-term member of the Minnesota Senate Education Committee, I watched from afar with curious interest. My admiration for the governor grew as I better understood his vision for education. My admiration for my bipartisan legislative colleagues also grew as I watched them perform legislative cartwheels to get the governor's controversial initiatives passed. Take PSEO. Republican House Majority Leader Connie Levi, with support from Quie, sponsored the new post-secondary initiative and made it her top priority from Perpich's package of reforms. She got the initiative into the House Omnibus Education Funding Bill. In the DFL Senate, however, the bill never moved. But the Senate Omnibus Education Funding Bill included another Perpich initiative, a statewide art school, which never moved in the House. Nelson authored the Senate bill. Perpich was now in the catbird seat. That is, the enviable position where the legislature was trading for two things he wanted. Levi and Nelson got together, made the deal, and both PSEO and the art school became law in 1985. As I reflect on those years, I realize I hadn't even heard of the term chartered schools at that time. But in reality, chartering was already happening. In a May 2011 interview, Loritz said, "The truth of the matter is that post-secondary enrollment options was essentially the first charter. Colleges were granted a charter to operate 11th and 12th grades. And the art school was another charter. The state had created a school by granting it a charter." The educational establishment, solidly focused on open enrollment, responded angrily, alleging that PSEO had been slipped through the process. Loritz remembers well the fallout. Everybody was mad in the education community. So the governor sent me to meet with the unions, school board associations, and everyone else, which I did. They were so mad. I've never seen them so mad. Our first reaction to PSEO was, "Well, here's another challenge to our jobs," recalled Louise Sundin in an August 2011 interview. Sundin, who became president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers Union in 1984, recalled that declining enrollment was a huge issue at the time. She explained what was happening. "I think 1979 to 1984 was the big drop in students in Minneapolis. Superintendent Richard Green closed 18 schools, and we all got reassigned, and we lost a lot of teachers. That was, of course, pretty traumatic for teachers. We weren't the only place where this was happening, so teachers were concerned for their jobs. So the first reaction to PSEO, and later to charters, was they'll take more kids out of public schools and we'll lose more jobs yet. That was a pretty big deal." The Minnesota Federation of Teachers also challenged PSEO unsuccessfully in court. It was the fact that kids could go to religious post-secondary institutions, Sundin explained. It was based on the philosophy that there shouldn't be public funding going to religious institutions for any reason. That's why we challenged it in court. With emotions running high, Loritz told the education groups he would recommend creation of a governor's discussion group on education. Moreover, the discussion group would have approval power for anything the governor proposed in the future. Loritz recalled, "What happened was the governor called the groups together, but he also invited Ted Coldery, Joe Nathan, Vern Johnson, Al Cui, and a whole bunch of folks who were on the reform side of the agenda. When Rudy called them together in the summer of 85, the groups got up and threatened to walk out. Rudy just looked at them and said, 'If you walk out, no deal. I will bring whatever you agree to, but you have to agree to it with these people.'" For the balance of 1985 and for the 1986 legislative session, the governor didn't bring anything new to the legislature because the group didn't want anything. Instead, the governor focused on protecting PSEO from repeal. PSEO passed in May 1985. The governor knew he had to get PSEO into operation by fall of 1985 or risk its repeal in the 1986 legislative session. With the bill signed on June 27, 1985, the start of the school year was only a month and a half away. Perpich insisted that his staff move quickly. At the governor's direction, Loritz dispatched Bob Wadle and Jesse Montano of the Minnesota Department of Education to launch a rigorous effort to implement the program, including the development and implementation of comprehensive guidelines to assist secondary and post-secondary institutions, a telephone information hotline, and regional meetings around the state. The two were to make sure that students enrolled in the program by September. They did. When the 1986 session rolled around, plenty of students and parents could testify in support of PSEO. The vote to repeal wasn't even close. A constituency for PSEO was building, and support for it was heard during the 1986 elections. That was likely a factor when the 1987 Governor's Discussion Group recommended support for the post-secondary program, as well as support of a voluntary version of open enrollment. Resistance to mandatory open enrollment still existed. Voluntary open enrollment, however, was less threatening to opponents. Districts would volunteer to open their doors to allow students to enroll or take leave of their schools. No district would be required to participate. In 1987, voluntary open enrollment passed into law, even with the House of Representatives now back in DFL control. Once again, Perpich moved quickly to build a constituency. According to Loritz, the governor sent letters to 160 school superintendents identified as entrepreneurial or innovative leaders and encouraged them to sign on. 95 districts agreed. In my years in the Senate, I learned never to underestimate the power of choice. When citizens can make their own decisions about what is best for them and their children, they do. A number of students took immediate advantage of open enrollment opportunities offered in those 95 districts. By the school year 1987 to 1988, more than 5,000 students had enrolled in PSEO. Stories of re-energized students emerged and were shared with legislators. Other existing choice options, such as alternative schools, where students ages 12 to 21 who did not succeed in one public school could attend another, were already thriving in some parts of the state. As always happens with customer satisfaction, a constituency of support for these public school choices emerged. And this is where I enter the story. I still smile when I think about how mandatory open enrollment finally passed in 1988. The Minnesota Business Partnership had approached me to sponsor a bill they had developed. Among its proposals was mandatory statewide testing. Near the end of the comprehensive bill was legislation implementing mandatory open enrollment. As a second-term senator and first-term member of the influential Senate Education Funding Division, now chaired by Senator Randy Peterson upon Nelson's retirement, I was blissfully unaware of the past history behind passage of open enrollment. I had no qualms about sponsoring the bill. No one expected the bill to pass during the short, non-budget 1988 legislative session. But we hoped to reshape the debate around Perpich's vision for what constituted mandatory open enrollment. We would make clear that under his vision, a student would always have the right to leave a school, and school districts would always have the right to close their doors to accepting new students, for example, if there wasn't room. I did not expect what happened next when I introduced the Minnesota Business Partnerships Bill. A firestorm of opposition erupted, not about open enrollment, but about the mandatory statewide testing in my bill. Clearly, testing legislation wasn't going anywhere fast. Far more interesting to me, however, was that in all the firestorm about testing, virtually no one came to talk with me about the mandatory open enrollment portion of the bill. Not even the governor's staff. It was as if we had fought that battle and it was over. Done. I talked with Peterson. Could we possibly add mandatory open enrollment as an amendment to the 1988 Omnibus Education Funding Bill? Was the timing right? We agreed to try. As chair, Peterson was fully supportive. He had to be for this to work. Our Senate education funding colleagues of both parties were quite strong on public school choice, so they were willing to help. I presented the amendment to the Senate committee. Unlike the previous year, in which legislators debated the issue ad nauseum, little discussion ensued in 1988. The Senate adopted the provision, and mandatory open enrollment became part of the omnibus education funding bill headed for the Senate floor. The media took 4 days to figure out what had happened. By that time, the Senate had passed the omnibus education funding bill by a wide margin and had sent it to the conference committee. The Senate had done its job. Peterson would take the lead in conference committee. As the debate about open enrollment belatedly raged on in the media, I looked to Perpich and Loritz to help enroll the House. Frankly, I couldn't contact either of them. I knew the House had taken no action on open enrollment, and the House had the most vigorous opponents to open enrollment during past years. I thought it would take a Hail Mary pass to get something like this adopted in conference committee without the governor's active support. Then, out of the blue, the deal was done. Open enrollment would be phased in for all school districts throughout the state over 2 years. The larger school districts would go first, and the smaller ones would follow. Only years later would I learn that the deal had already been secretly cut between Loritz and Representative Ken Nelson, chair of the House Education Finance Division, who was waiting for statewide open enrollment to show up in the conference committee. Loritz and the governor had intentionally stayed clear of the issue for fear that the governor's other initiatives would be held hostage. At session end, to the surprise of many, including me, open enrollment for all public school districts was the law of the state of Minnesota, the first such law in the country, and Representative Nelson would soon become a key legislator in passage of chartered schools.